7557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, good afternoon, Todd and company. We're here today to talk about an interesting subject called airworthiness. And with us today, we have a couple of special guests. First one is Sarah McLeod, Executive Director of the Aeronautical Repair Station Association, well-known worldwide by a lot of people. And we're also joined by Mike Borfus, who is Kilroy Aviation, is his connection to aviation today. But in prior lives, like Todd, he was at Boeing and also at the FAA and is responsible for a lot of the stupid decisions we have to work around today. Oh,
pleasure, John.
Hey, what is his way of getting job security, John? Give him a break.
Now, for those of you who are seeing these folks for the very first time, these are both previous guests on the show. And if I'm doing my job right, I should be flashing some episode numbers where you can find previous iterations of what they've had to say. And I promise everyone watching today that this will be an unredacted show. So if the conversation gets, how should I say it, hot and heavy, you will hear 100% of it.
So, and today we all know one another, so this thing may get out of control quickly. So this is going to be an interesting adventure today, maybe quite different than what we normally have. But airworthiness is a subject that's near and dear to pilots, mechanics, dispatchers. There's a lot of people who touch an airplane to determine that it's safe to fly. And that part of that safe to fly is the airworthiness. That means the mechanical ability of the airplane to accomplish its job, which is to fly people safely from point A to point B. And it is a very touchy subject. It has a lot of different faces to it, depending upon who's looking at the problem. So we're going to get into it. We're probably going to have differences of opinion, and that's good. So there's no format to this, so we're just going to go. So, Sarah, since I'm a mechanic, what is your view of airworthiness from a mechanic's point of view?
Well, the work must be performed in an airworthy manner. And I think Section 4313, which every mechanic should probably have tattooed someplace, basically says you're going to do the job right. You're going to use the right equipment. You're going to use the right materials. You're going to use the right instructions, methods, techniques, and practices acceptable to the administrator that returns the item to at least its original or properly altered condition. It's a judgment call that has to be made, no pun intended, on the fly by a mechanic that's knowledgeable about what he's doing. So back it up one more. A mechanic can't do work that he hasn't done before to the satisfaction of another mechanic who has done it, or to the administrator, and we won't usually talk about making demonstrations to the administrator of my capabilities as a mechanic, but the mechanic has to have the knowledge, tooling, equipment, and data to do the job right. If I get old equipment where I haven't had a change in a maintenance manual for 25 years, I have to look at the configuration of the aircraft or the piece part and make a determination of how to return it to at least its original condition.
So you just touched on a subject that that's near and dear to my heart sometimes, and that is the condition of the airplane after many, many years, and who's touched it, what modifications have done to it, because it doesn't take long after an airplane's built before it starts to deviate from the way it looked when it left the factory. Lots of things are done to the airplanes. Doesn't mean it's unsafe, but it means it has changed some. Sometimes with the proper paperwork, sometimes without it. But it comes down. And in the midst of all this, who relies upon the mechanic daily for that? It's the pilots. Right? So the pilot has a role in airworthiness because he has to make a determination before every flight that the airplane is in a condition to fly. So, and Todd, well, maybe we'll get to your little example that you had trying to make of that determination in a little bit. So it's interesting. Mr. Borfus, from the certification side, would you like to weigh in on this one?
Oh, hell yes, please. I'm going to start out with a little bit of geeky information. I begin with part three, 14 CFR part three, general requirements. And 3.5A defines airworthy as means the aircraft conforms to its type design and is in a condition for safe operation. We touched on both of those. Now, there's another minor change to that definition I've run into elsewhere, and that is conforms to its approved design. So we run into both of those things. So to me, the first part's black and white. You have a part, you have an entire aircraft that's represented by a drawing, right? Or a set of drawings, processes, procedures, and so on. And that's just black and white. Either it conforms or it doesn't. Period, end of story. The second part is a judgment call and is a condition for safe operation. Nobody can look at a book and make that determination. It has to be based on experience, basically knowledge, and that's actually faith in the system and the people who have done the work. So that's kind of the way I look at it. It's a
So,
two
Mike,
part.
just as a little aside, as a mechanic, how would I get a hold of the drawings?
You'd
Well,
have to, you're not going to be able to do that, John. We know that. All you have is the drawings are going to have an airworthiness certificate on it. The part's going to have an airworthiness certificate on it. The airplane's going to have an airworthiness certificate on it. And anyone who signs that airworthiness certificate basically is saying this does conform to its type design.
right.
Gets
So
right
that's a
down to every
lie.
piece
So what
part.
you're telling me, that's a lie. Slow down a minute. All right, it's a lie because I have no idea what's on that drawing, and
it's
I
an
can't edit
unknown.
that drawing.
Well, there's where you depend on the system and the people who work in the system and everything that's piled up to that very moment where the certificate is presented for signature.
See,
So,
this is so interesting because this is so engineers have the ability to be more puritanical than a mechanic does, John. Okay,
no
so you
question.
can be under the illusion that that's black and white. Your drawing may be black and white, usually got blue in there someplace and some other colors on the drawing, but it's made. Okay, if you think that it is made exactly like that drawing is it represents, okay, maybe 90% of the time. But even in manufacturing, you have tolerances, Michael. Right. And
Yes.
so when it says that it meets its approved design, let's talk about how the type certificate or production approval holder handles their MRBs. Right.
There,
Does
there.
it, does
Okay.
it,
All right.
does it, does the part after it's made actually complete or, fulfill its obligation within the design? These are a bunch of parts flying in close formation, Michael. They're not all perfect, all right? But they do meet the airworthiness requirements for the flight. And John, if you look at some of the even, and I hate lawyers trying to make these decisions. I swear to God, one of these days I'm going to be in court saying, we got 10 lawyers in here that can't figure this out. And I got one mechanic that was trying to get the aircraft out the door. Right? Because we all do have this. But when I'm in maintenance and I make a decision based on knowledge and experience, The FAA has to prove I'm wrong. In Michael's position, he has to prove that he's right. That puts him in a weaker position. If the mechanic believes that the aircraft was airworthy, met an approved design, because as soon as that pipe design, as soon as that aircraft goes out of production, like John said, it gets dings and nicks and dinks and whatever, but it still operates as intended. All right, meets an approved design and in the condition for safe operation. John, you've been a mechanic for a long time. You can actually sign for an aircraft that doesn't meet its approved design but can operate safely to get it to a maintenance base, right?
Did it hundreds of times.
So I think
I'm actually in violent agreement with you.
You've got to be careful of the expectation on the design side, Michael, because I agree with you. On the design side, it seems real black and white.
Yep.
But it's never operated like it was intended, right?
Well, let me, okay, so here we go. First of all, a design, as approved, has four basic elements to it. It has dimensions, tolerances, process specs, and material specs, those four things, right? The tolerance is the big thing. You actually talked about that. And there's the MRB. When an airplane goes through the production line, somebody discovers something that's, well, it doesn't meet the type design. So what do? We squawk it, we put a ticket on it, and it follows the airplane until that ticket is dealt with in some way. Then we get into major versus minor changes. When you get into MRB, you talk about use as is, which means could be a judgment call. Could be, okay, it's not a big deal. It's a minor thing. Just let it go through. That's a minor determination which has to be dealt with. It's all going to be recorded in one way or another. So when the airplane is finally delivered, in many cases, especially in the early days, these aircraft are craft built, right? They really are craft built. They can, a 747 can differ in length and wingspan by a foot or two, depending on how tolerances are built up. Then these aircraft go into service. The same thing applies to parts, by the way, right? An engine hub or a motor or even a windshield or a lavatory door handle, for crying out loud. They can all differ a little bit. Then when they're put into service, the first person who touches that lavatory door handle may very well change it in some way. And there's where things get a little bit messy. I mean, I use that word intentionally. It's a little bit messy because a baggage handler may very well ding the skin a little bit. Okay, somebody sees a ding. Are they going to ground the airplane? No. They're going to make a judgment call.
Again, maybe.
Yeah.
When we round at, John, one of the, I fell over laughing in a couple of areas. Number one, an ashtray, as you may or may not know, in a commercial operation, 121 is a no-go item. If the ashtray is broken because it was used as a coat hanger, because that's what they look like now, right? It's this little tiny thing. $4 million or something a year is spent because they have to replace the door. They can't go without the ashtray, or they have to block off the lab.
Yep.
Now, nobody uses the ashtray. Do you know what people use when they smoke in lavatories to put out their cigarettes? Are you ready for this? The trash can.
Yeah, we've had a number of fires.
When I was smoking in the bathroom when I was a teenager, we threw it in the toilet, for Christ's sake.
There you go.
You didn't start a fire in the trash can, all right? But I'm just trying to say, is the aircraft really unairworthy because the ashtray is broken? Not in a 91 situation, it wouldn't be. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because the higher degree of safety is with a 121. And Mike, when you make an aircraft, right, when you're at Boeing, you're selling to the highest degree of safety. But a lot of that equipment doesn't have to be on an aircraft if I'm selling it to John Travolta.
Now, hold on a second. I got a case study that I've been building based on the comments here, trying to understand the concept of airworthiness for the semi-average person out there. You know, we had some discussions offline. Is airworthiness next to godliness, or is airworthiness in the eye of the beholder? So here's a case study. Four people. You got the first officer, not the captain. You've got a flight attendant. You have the mechanic who's working on the airplane that day, and you have an executive of the airline who happens to have a background in engineering, was a designer, never flew, never was a mechanic, but this is a high mucky muck in the organization. For some reason, one of these people decides that, hey, they're standing up, this plane is not airworthy, it should not fly. Who of those four people actually have the power to keep the airplane on the ground?
The pilot does and the mechanic does.
The first officer does
Agree.
over the captain?
Oh, I'm sorry. Love you. That would depend on the airline, I'm
The
guessing.
pilot in command, as defined by Part
So the
91.
PIC is the one that actually, but the mechanic, if the mechanic is doing maintenance and refuses to approve it for return to service, the pilot better not bloody fly it. I mean,
Yep,
he
here I
can,
am.
but he's replacing his opinion with the mechanics, and that's kind of dangerous for a pilot to do.
But the VP of the airline, who is over in one form or another all the other three people's jobs, if they disagree with him or her, it could affect their careers in a negative way. Even though this executive has no regulatory power to ground the airplane, would
You know, I
natural human
appreciate
reaction be, well, let's do what the vice president says?
that. I
Well, you know,
appreciate
the
that, but
operating
his.
manual for most airlines has a pecking order. So the mechanic, if he says I'm not signing it, I don't agree with it, there is a procedure in the manual, in policy and procedures, not the maintenance manual, that says who can override him. So I had managers, not it's usually not the immediate supervisor, it's usually a manager, who could override my signature as a crew chief.
Did he have a
And
certificate, John?
yes,
Then he put his
no,
certificate at risk, right? So
right,
Todd,
bingo.
you talk about the putting your you will put your career at risk if you fly in an unairworthy aircraft.
And you know it.
And you know
Well,
it.
I mean,
And you
well,
know
yes, of course, if you know it. Sorry, John. Yeah, I mean, although they'll accuse you, the FAA can accuse you whether you knew it or not.
it. Yeah. That's right. Of course.
If
Executive
they say
Vice
you should
President.
have known it because it was in the logbook and you didn't sign off, then and the annual wasn't signed off for a 91 guy, or a squawk wasn't signed off, that pilot can't fly even in a 121 situation.
Or
Now,
shouldn't, yeah.
remember, you guys, you're talking about now not airworthiness anymore. I made a decision as a mechanic. I'm not flying or I'm not signing it off, and the pilot made that. That's the regulation. Now we can talk about human relations. In aviation, Todd, you know I'm going to come down on the fact I don't give a damn what your boss says. You better look at the rule. You don't answer to the boss when you're flying an aircraft. You're going to answer to the safety organization.
You know, it's
So the
funny you're
mechanic is
saying
going to
that.
tell the vice president to take a hike.
I would if I was a mechanic, otherwise I wouldn't be in aviation. This is the what we expect, love. And that's what 14 CFR expects. Now, the fact that we're never going to fulfill it is a different issue.
That's not true. I worked for some guys who did it. In
The
fact,
hell I'm
I
not.
had a supervisor, the VP of maintenance, called up in the morning. We were having a bad day across the whole system and started to berate him on the fact that we had captured a few airplanes in Boston. And he turned around and screamed on the phone that I didn't break your goddamn airplanes. I'll call you when they're fixed. And he hung up. And then he looked at me and says, I'll be fired by noon. I said, he doesn't have the backbone to fire you for that by noon. Maybe he'll find something else, but he's not going to touch that one.
Let me bring to your attention right now, brand new subpart D for 14 CFR Part 3. Subpart D reads falsification, reproduction, alteration, omission, or incorrect statements. It was published September 3rd, 2025. It is brand spanking new. It actually brought together all similar statements from all the regulations throughout 14, sub without throughout Title 14, and put them into a single regulation. And it, everybody had best be aware of that.
They were always there though. 21-12, 43-12, 145-12. The falsification was always there, Mike. They just
Of
brought it
course.
into one section, right? And they
Well,
did change the language. Here's what's really interesting about this. Omissions now. You omit a life limit. Now again, you have to have purpose. They have to prove that you had the intent. And by the way, it's not that damn hard when you really are falsifying.
Well, if you, and in my defense, I did say it brought together all the old regulations. But
Correct.
if you had, for example, three or four major repairs, and you put something in a 337, and you left one of them out and signed it off, that would be an omission.
Yeah, and you'd have to have done it on purpose, right?
Yes. Yes.
For the purpose of fraud or misleading somebody.
Yes.
Leaving it out, you know, by accident is still supposed to be. Here's what happened,
nope.
Oh, gentlemen. The lawyer, the aviation safety inspector ain't looking for innocence. Oh, shoot, I should have put it in there. Will turn into he knew it wasn't in there.
Yep.
So I get very nervous around it because you can make mistakes. Nobody makes paperwork perfect. John, I mean, geez, we've got this stupid legal opinion and et cetera that I can just put overhauled in a maintenance record and that's enough. Well, it is under the regulation, but you and I need to know what parts were replaced. You know, you need a whole bunch of other stuff in order to be able to make the next decision. To Mike's point, if I only change the oil, I guess that's preventative maintenance. But so the pilot changes the oil in a 91 situation and doesn't write it down. And he puts too much oil in his reciprocating engine. He had the right to do the maintenance. He was supposed to know what he was doing. He's going to fly an unairworthy aircraft. I don't know what you're doing in maintenance.
Let me ask a question.
We're the last line of defense, man. We're the last line of defense. Look at some of these accidents that happened because maintenance didn't do its job.
Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks. First access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in! Because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before.
We have decades each of experience in the industry. We've seen
sure.
all kinds of things firsthand, heard all kinds of other things secondhand. I'm speaking to the folks John and I especially deal with all the time, the young mechanics coming into the system. They're in A&P schools. They're in their first or second job as a mechanic. They're listening to us thinking, oh, my God, what did I get myself into?
Right.
So what advice or what examples are we giving to these folks by telling these, how should I say it, somewhat interesting tales?
I think that it tells you that if you want to be the best, you need this is the place to be. You will
Ooh, I like that.
Always learn. You will always be, I mean, God, look at John. He never stopped learning. I've never stopped learning. You've never stopped learning. It's the perfect place for somebody that wants that kind of responsibility and takes it seriously and will learn and will say, no, I don't know. I mean, we talk about societal, you know, machoism and all of the other things that prevent humans from doing the right thing. And this is why, my vice president of operations says, airworthiness is next to godliness, because we read a Bible called, called the maintenance manual, called 14 CFR. And you can either read it for the positive results that you'll get, or you can read it to join the devil.
We have this little phrase in Kilroy. It's performance and integrity. Basically, perform, do the very best job you can, which goes along with continue to learn, and then the integrity part is tell on yourself if you do something wrong or ask for help, and then once you do that, you fix it, you put it back into performance, you loop through it a couple times, make sure it's done properly, make sure that it's in place, you might say, and then go back to performance. But the integrity part is the important part. We cannot survive without integrity. I mean, going back to what we were talking about with with an airworthiness certificate, I look at an airworthiness certificate, and I am absolutely dependent on the integrity of the entire system and every individual who's touched anything that led up to that particular point, whether it's an airworthiness certificate on an airplane or a part, a lavatory door handle again.
But as a mechanic, I can be super suspicious, right? Because there are things that get missed during the operating day in a 121 environment, right?
Sure.
So, and the more you touch these aircraft, they're kind of like a human body. When I go into heavy check, in fact, it's interesting because John, the legislation, I don't know, 4 or 5 re-auths ago, said, we want to know the statistics of these planes that are coming out of heavy check. Well, the first 90 days out of a heavy check, you're shaking things out again. I mean, if you did major modifications, you're gonna find that there's a lot of squawks in those first 30, 60 days. Is that the fault of maintenance? I mean, are we looking for error? I love the way that Congress wants us to all, fess up that we are, actually doing things badly all of the time, and we have to be checked all of the time. But you understand what I'm saying, gentlemen? I mean, we recognize some of these things, Todd, that will make people fairly nervous, I suppose. If they're going to listen to it, then, go, do as much cross-examination of your car's mechanic.
I found it interesting here that the press has been ripping Boeing every chance they get when somebody it pops up that an airplane coming out of the factory has this problem or that problem, right? I work for an airline that receives a lot of brand new airplanes while I was there,
Right.
and I hated it when I saw that I had a brand new airplane coming in, right? Because I knew what that meant. It was things all over the airplane that we had to go deal with that we never normally had to touch. But they're just
So,
things that weren't quite right when they came out, or only lasted just a short period of time before they showed up as having a problem.
let me
And
ask a
that's right.
question.
Well,
Let me
you're
ask a
saying like
question.
things like tools and rags and gas tanks, wires that are not connected to anything, and fritters have been gnawing at things and they're broken before they get delivered. Are you talking about things like that?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. All
And
right.
late in the later generation airplanes in the 80s and 90s, we're putting airplanes out like crazy. Occasionally, you would find a tool left behind. You didn't find rags. I never found any rags. And there were some wiring problems that splices all over the airplane. And a splice may
Sometimes
be.
it's just a shakeout, Todd.
Yep.
Sometimes it's just a shakeout, man. It was flown for 5 hours or something. What's the test flight, Michael, on every aircraft?
It's a B1, B2. It's a shakeout, basically, what you said.
Yeah, but it's only like
And
3 hours.
in that neighborhood, yeah, because the assumption is the airplane is going to be complete.
It's not in the operating environment of the carrier. So
Right.
I mean, that
Unless.
may be the first damn time that that aircraft flew past a half an hour at a time.
Unless problems are found. You know, the tests are intended to look for problems. And they depend on prior tests. And also there's a customer flight as well. And let me ask a question, basically just for fun. How complex are these airplanes? What's the likelihood that an airplane is going to be in perfect condition when it's delivered?
Zero.
Basically zero. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And we know that. things are going to happen because they're very, very complex. Their systems is what they are. That's even worse because these new airplanes are basically flying computers.
Well, and they're so redundant on the redundancies of the redundancies that, you know, we're going to run into some of these areas that doesn't bring an aircraft out of the air.
Right.
Let me
the FAA needs a Department of Redundancy Department.
Here's one of my favorite stories of my days at Boeing. As many of you know, Boeing has its 737 fuselages built in Wichita, and it's shipped on rail to the Puget Sound area. That's been going on for decades. In fact, I used to live in a part of town very close to one of the rail yards where they would like marshal them in before coming to the factory. I sometimes see half a dozen or so out there. Then one day I noticed there were like blanket-looking things in the sides of these fuselages. Asked around, they said, oh, we've had some issues. People out west would shoot at these things. We'd have to repair the holes before we...
Target practice.
Yeah, bullet holes.
Yes, I mean, that was known for years, especially when you went through the mountain passes.
So some of you out there are not laughing when you hear this story.
Any respect? Do you think there's any respect for aviation, Todd?
Well, I mean, that was what they call, was it primer? Is that what they call the green stuff? It's like
right.
Really shiny and green. It's like really pretty.
Yeah, can't miss it in the woods.
Yeah, nice shade of green. You know, we've been talking about these subjects that the group, as a group, we know about here, but the people listening to this podcast, and particularly mechanics and pilots, we're talking about subjects that they never even address at all. It's always in the background. Airworthiness is, you know, like in the beauties and the eye of the beholder. You know, pilots look at airplanes and, you know, tires and brakes and leaks, essentially. And if they don't find any, the airplane's airworthy. But it goes deeper than that. They're supposed to know about the condition of the airplane. They're not supposed to know. And in fact, Todd, your example of going out to fly an airplane and finding out that there was something had done been done to the airplane, and yet you couldn't find out what it was.
Well, that is, you just gave me the perfect segue to the second to last word. It's going to be a story this time. Okay, I'm getting back into flying again after years away, and I want to work on my instrument rating and such. So I'm regularly going out to my aero club and renting an airplane and flying it. There was one airplane I'd flown several times before, doing the pre-flight check, starting on the left wing, the empennage. Going around to the right wing, I noticed something unusual. The nuts and bolts and the aileron and such in the wing were all brand new, bright shiny brass. And I said, am I seeing something? I went back to the left wing. It was like grimy like it was last time I flew it. And this other wing is like all this new hardware. I'm thinking, that's odd. I go and fly my flight, come back and ask around. They said, oh, that airplane was in maintenance. It had a wing strike a few weeks ago and they just replaced the wing. I'm like, what? Nobody told me? If you told me ahead of time this just had a wing replaced, I'd ask all kinds of questions. One of them being, is there another plane I can fly today? Because I didn't want to fly in that plane until I was sure in my own mind that I was flying an airworthy aircraft. So I did a logical thing. It's like I asked around, hey, can I look at the maintenance records? My particular organization, the Aero Club, said basically, why are you asking that question? We don't show our maintenance records to just any pilot. It's like, wait a minute, I'm flying this plane. Is this like an unusual or unrealistic request? I just want to make sure that things were done right. I don't care if I can't understand 99% of what's in the logbooks. I want to take a look-see to see if there is a logbook, if someone wrote something legible, if I can go to a regulation and say, okay, they followed the regulations when they came to this. I never got those answers, by the way, and I'm no longer in that flying club.
Good choice, because I've asked the same question, Todd. I've asked people in IA training, because sometimes pilots show up, do you guys belong to a flying club? Because you know you're the PIC when you take that aircraft out. If you're depending on somebody else to have done the maintenance, I don't know if that's a real intelligent thing to do. Why isn't the logbook in the aircraft? Isn't the right? And they, I get the same, you know, kind of deer in the headlights, because what Mike said is only partially true. Yes, we depend upon the mechanic, but I'm responsible when I'm the pilot. I'm responsible I've had pilots tell me, in fact, I had a, pilot lawyer say, "I don't think that's true, Sarah." And I said, "Well, go read 91." I mean,
Well,
you're on your own now. So I admire that. I think that the any flying club that doesn't have the logbook in the aircraft for every pilot to look at isn't doing pilots very much good. It's
as a
not teaching
requirement
them
for a logbook,
responsibilities.
is it required for a logbook to be in the airplane? I think not.
No, you don't have to have
No.
an airplane.
It's not.
It now not by rights, it should be available to the PIC. I mean, if I were the PIC in
Absolutely.
that situation, I wanted to see the logbooks, I would expect to see it to make that determination.
By the
Do
way, there's more to the story. I was
all
so
right.
not happy with the response I got. I said, "Let me go legal on this." I did a FOIA request for the event that caused this airplane to have a damaged wing. And the FAA, to their credit, gave me a whole lot of stuff, plenty of pictures of the accident. I had all the information I needed about the event. What I've never gotten to this day, well, I left the Aero Club, is all the information I needed from the maintenance logbooks. John, it is time for the last word.
No, we can't cut this to short. We'll
I
come back to this some more. There's so much to say here, from the
kidding.
mechanics. We got a lot of young mechanics today, and we probably need a good tutorial for both pilots and mechanics on the interface between maintenance and flight crew, because it's disconnected now, many cases. I hop on the pre-flights and I tell pilots, if you don't know how to do a good pre-flight, go get a mechanic that works on the airplane. But I'll bet you that hasn't happened, right? Mechanics, when I walked up to an airplane, I was already doing an inspection when I got 100 feet away from it. I was looking at the airplane, looking at how it sits, right? Just in general, you know what the airplane looks like, you know what the pieces are. What is there anything that looks different, looks unusual? And it goes into the weeds from there. And pilots should have the same view, but I know they don't. I know that maybe some do. Can't make a blanket statement, but I can say that most don't look at it that way. I
It's an
see.
experience thing too, right?
I sit in FBOs. I still do. I work in FBOs. I sit in FBOs having coffee, watch what people do, and I shake my head sometimes. And it's sometimes with business aircraft, I'm shaking my head. It's not a Mu 91. It's not just 91. It goes up to 135s and probably higher. So we got to pay attention. So I'll do my standard speech now. If you're going to go flying, you need to go do a good pre-planning session. Do it at home before you go to the airport. Do it again at the airport. Make sure they agree. When you get out to the airplane, a good pre-flight. When you get into the air, put that head on a swivel, because we have a lot of student pilots out there today, and they make mistakes. You don't want to be part of their mistake. So keep your head on a swivel, and please fly safely.
Let me talk to the folks who have joined the Flight Safety Detectives, our members. We thank you very much for doing so, and we're hoping that you are enjoying your membership and the benefits that come with that, including getting early access to new episodes and other goodies to be determined later. And if you're interested in becoming a member, you'll see a graphic on the screen with an arrow pointing to the join button on the YouTube channel. Join. Do what is necessary to become a member at whatever level you'd like and enjoy those benefits. And if you have questions, whether or not you're a member or not, write to us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. And we're not leaving out sponsors. We love sponsors. We can always use more, and we hope that you can use our content to attract our audience to your product or service. Contact us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. We'll have a conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
For decades, Avemco Insurance Company has been an advocate for pilot safety by promoting and sponsoring continuous pilot training and education. One of their initiatives has been to reward pilots who actively participate in being more proficient with savings on their insurance premium through the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Pilots save by earning new ratings, getting recurrent training, participating in the Fast Team Wing program, and listening to podcasts like ours and other Avemco-related courses and training. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for an automatic 5% off.